Welcome to the Premier Advisor Live Series. I would now like to turn the call over to Gina Puglisi, Vice President, Premier Safety Institute.
Thank you, Janika, and good afternoon from Charlotte, and welcome to Premier's Advisor Live Series. I'm Gina Puglisi. I'm the Vice President of Premier Safety Institute, and I'm your host for today, as well as being part of the faculty. We're recording this teleconference, and we're going to be posting it to our Advisor Live homepage at premierinc.com/advisorlive in about 24 hours after the program. After the formal presentations today, our operator, Janika, is going to tell us about how to ask questions live. And we're also delighted to tell you that Dr. Michael Bell from the Centers for Disease Control is going to be joining us for the question and answer session. I'd like to begin the program by introducing our speakers, and also to tell you about we're going to be asking a couple of survey questions during the program that will be on your screen. They'll only take a few seconds to answer, and it'll give us all a perspective from our audience today about how they're responding to some of the key issues that we're dealing with. And so we'll be able to see that during the program. There'll be just a couple of questions in between the speakers. So I'd like to introduce our faculty for today. Joining me is going to be Linda Green, who's the Director of Infection Prevention at Rochester General Hospital in Rochester, New York, and Barbara Russell, who's the Vice Chair of Baptist South Florida Emergency Preparedness Council in Miami, Florida. Unfortunately, Carol Nassif, Infection Prevention at Fairview Ridges Hospital in Minnesota, will not be joining us today. She called us late last night to tell us that she sends her regrets and to let you know that she has the H1N1 flu, and she will not be joining us. So I have a couple of her slides that I'm going to share with you during the program, and we have included a copy of her slides on our website. And the link to all of the slides for today's program, for those of you that you wanted to download them and not follow along on the Internet link that was provided, you can go to premierinc.com/advisorlive, and you can download those slides. So I will begin. Next slide. I'm going to start by talking about what the influenza activity has been in the United States. Next slide. This is a representation of what was going on in the United States in terms of flu in the middle of August. And as you can see, the dark beige states are those states that have had widespread activity about in the middle of August. And those lighter beige states are those where the activity has been sporadic. Next slide. 2 weeks later, we were up to 12 states that had widespread activity. Next. As you can see here, by September 19th, we had nearly 30 states that were showing widespread activity. So this flu has really progressed very rapidly across the country. Next slide. This is 2 weeks later. We're up to 40 states. And the next slide. Current status is right now we're up to 46 states that are reporting widespread activity, which is very unusual for this time of year. It's very early in the season to see this much flu. Next slide. If you look at the outpatients that are reporting influenza-like illness, you can see we have a huge spike in the week that we're in right now on the far right of this slide. And these yellow, orange arrows are the same time from 2006, 2007, and 2008 flu seasons. And as you can see, we're way ahead of the number of patients that have been reporting for influenza-like illnesses. Right now, the range the overall range for visits for influenza-like illness range anywhere from 2% to 12%, depending on what part of the country you're in. And the national baseline is about 2%, so we're way above that. And in some parts of the country, they're seeing, you know, huge increases in people coming in with influenza-like illness, and a lot of worried well coming in to be evaluated because they're concerned. Next slide. This is just a snapshot of what kinds of viruses have been positive and reported to the CDC from a variety of laboratories. And as you can see, the H1N1 2009 is orange, and this is up through the 35th week here. Most of these viruses in the last couple of weeks since April have been the H1N1 type. Next slide. This is the last couple of weeks for the 2009-2010 flu season. And again, for those last couple of weeks, the majority of isolates that we're seeing are H1N1 for those that are being typed. This is a very stable virus, and there has been actually no change in the virus, and it's the same virus that's been used to formulate the vaccines. And it remains susceptible to both both of the antivirals, oseltamivir and zanamivir. Next slide, please. Recently, the CDC reported data on the ages of hospitalized cases, and this is just a brief summary of what we've seen in the last 6 weeks. Out of nearly 5,000 hospitalized cases reporting from 27 states, a little more than half of the patients are under 25. Nearly 40% are between 25 and 65, and 7% of the cases are over 65. Very different than what we see in seasonal flu, which is a much higher percentage of cases over 65. Next. Overall, CDC has a recommended approach to fighting the flu, and this slide just kind of summarizes what the goal has been, is to really educate the population on the need for vaccination, the importance of covering your cough, including cough hygiene, which is coughing into your elbow or your sleeve if you don't have Kleenex handy, frequent hand washing, staying home when you're sick, and using antivirals as indicated. We're going to hear a little bit more about some of the vaccination programs that are underway, but the H1N1 vaccination has started, although the initial supplies are smaller than what's expected. They are being rolled out. CDC does inform us that there will be enough vaccination for everybody that wishes to receive it. It's just getting released slower than originally thought. Next. On October 14th, the CDC released revised interim guidance for infection control for 2009 H1N1, which included some very specific recommendations for respiratory protection, and along with that, a very nice Q&A that went along with it, which is on the CDC website at www.cdc.gov/H1N1 flu. Next slide. In the CDC guidelines, these interim guidelines, they talk about the symptoms, which I have listed here, although the symptoms do vary depending on the age group and the individual person. Viral shedding usually begins a day or two before you actually have symptoms and can persist for up to 7 days or longer in children or severely immunocompromised patients, which has some indications for isolation and other things. The viral shedding is greatest in the first couple of days after illness, and it generally correlates with fever. So you're most infectious at the beginning of this illness, unlike something like SARS, where you were the infectivity increased as the disease progressed. So with this, you're either infectious before you actually come down with your symptoms or the very early part of the illness when there's fever. Next. The spread of 2009 H1N1 influenza transmission is similar to other flu viruses, which is, first of all, droplet exposure from people coughing or sneezing and respiratory secretions traveling short distances into the mouth, the nose, or the eyes of someone who's exposed. The second method of transmission is direct contact, for example, when your hands are touching an infected patient or surfaces that are contaminated with secretions, and then self-inoculation. And it's estimated that people touch their faces multiple times in an hour in observational studies. So we self-inoculate when our hands are not clean, and we've recently touched surfaces that have been touched by someone that has flu. And the third method of transmission is small particle aerosols, very short distance in the close vicinity within 6 feet of the infectious individual. This virus and the influenza virus is not believed to be traveling over long distances through the airborne route, for example, through the ventilation from one room to another, but rather some aerosol right in the vicinity of the patient. Next slide.
Gina?
Yes?
I'm getting a notice that many people are not seeing the slides. I wonder if it's possible to restate the webinar link or the link to download the slides so that people can follow if they can't get into the webinar. The link I have for downloading the slides from the website is www.premierinc.com/H1N1 flu. There are at least the slides to download.
Thank you, Judine. Yes, the slides are available for those of you that are not able to view the slides and wanted to view them on your own computer. www.premierinc.com/H1N1 flu or premierinc.com/advisorlive. They can be downloaded at either of those places. Thank you, Judine.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so revisions, these are some of, just to summarize some of the revisions that we have seen in these interim guidance, and I'm not going to go through each one of them, but I'll let you review them on the screen, but basically the revised guidance talks about the importance of identifying patients with suspect influenza. Clarifies the time away from work for healthcare workers who have had influenza for 24 hours after fever, so it's consistent with what's recommended for general return to work policies. And some changes in the isolation policies, which include standard precautions for everyone and N95s for workers in close contact, which is defined as being within 6 feet or in a small shared airspace like a patient room. Next slide. The most important part of the revised guidance is the whole what's called the hierarchy of control for infection control. And this starts out with really eliminating the source of infection and everything that you can do to make sure the virus is not present, which would be postponing elective visits of patients or procedures if they have illness. You're not bringing the virus then into the settings, denying entry to ill visitors or keeping ill workers at home, so you don't bring the virus into the setting and you eliminate the source of the virus or the source of infection. Your next level in the hierarchy would be what's called engineering controls, which would be barriers or using special airborne isolation rooms, for example, for aerosol-generating procedures, putting up physical barriers in triage areas so that you don't have droplet transmission short distance. It can be separated by a barrier. And then things like soap dispensers and for hand hygiene to be performed and providing education and trash containers to put soiled Kleenex in. Administrative controls are really your policies and procedures and work practices to make sure all this is done correctly. And the hallmark of that is getting people vaccinated and really enforcing some of these policies, as well as educating everyone, including your patients and your visitors, on cough etiquette and hand hygiene, and wearing a mask immediately if they have any respiratory symptoms. Personal protective equipment is the last in the hierarchy, and it includes wearing respiratory protection when you're in contact with patients who have a respiratory illness like influenza, and fit testing N95s for close contact. Next slide. So the respiratory protection, just to quickly review it, reaffirms the need for fit-tested N95s. These guidelines provide lots of options for how you implement a program for respiratory protection. And if you have not read the CDC guidelines or the very nice Q&A that goes along with it for both the full guideline and the Q&A for respiratory protection, I recommend that you read it because it provides a lot of information. And it gives a lot of information that has to be really adjusted by each individual facility. Some of it's clinical judgment, some of it's based on your patient populations and your local experiences to help you guide how you're actually going to roll this program out. And we're going to hear from our two additional speakers about what they're doing in their facilities on a variety of these topics, but it's really very facility specific. The guideline basically recommends that you use N95s or higher for at the very minimum high-risk procedures that generate aerosols. So aerosol-generating procedures like bronchoscopy or autopsies or intubation. If you're not doing a high-risk procedure and you have a shortage of N95 respirators that you have to prioritize their use and possibly use a surgical mask, and there's a whole hierarchy of how you decide how to do the prioritization, and it takes into consideration things like the vaccination status of the worker, whether they're in a high-risk group for complications, and what kind of exposure you're going to have and how frequently it happens. There's also some guidance on extending the use of these respirators with a variety of different options on that. Next slide. OSHA has announced that it's going to enforce worker protection components of the CDC guidance, which basically focus on the hierarchy of controls. They're going to be issuing what's called a CPL, which really provides uniform guidance to OSHA in how to evaluate healthcare employers providing protection within the hierarchy of controls. One of the things OSHA has announced is that you have to show a good faith effort that you've attempted to provide respiratory protection that's at least as effective as N95 respirators. And you need to document this, and if you're unable to provide respiratory protection at that level, you have to document your whole prioritization plan and how you've gone about determining who's going to be wearing an N95 or higher level of protection, like a powered air purifying respirator, and who's going to wear a mask, and how those workers are going to be decided based on all of the criteria that are in that guidance document. And document your attempt to purchase respirators and the inability to purchase them. Next slide. This is just a screenshot of the table that's in the CDC guidance, which talks about all these different things, and on a 1-4 scale helps you prioritize who has the highest level of priority for an N95. And this is not for aerosol-generating procedures where you must wear an N95 protection or higher. Next slide. Just a couple of slides I'm going to share of Carol Nassif, who couldn't be with us today. Next slide. Some of the challenges that they've had at Fairview are caring for patients and getting enough N95s, identifying cases, and doing exposure follow-ups. Next slide. One of the challenges has been fit testing in areas where fit testing was not done, like in clinics and ambulatory care, getting an adequate supply, particularly stocking multiple types of respirators and then trying to do the fit testing on various types because they can't get all one type of respirator as they had in the past, and then dealing, of course, with people's private stashes. Next slide. They are using a higher level of protection for high-risk procedures in some situations, the powered air purifying respirators, which requires very special staff education on these. Next slide. Their isolation is based on the Minnesota Department of Health's recommendations, which is droplet with contact precautions. They use a mask with a face shield, gloves for contact, and gowns for patients who are in the hospital. They reassign pregnant healthcare workers, and they use N95s for all aerosolizing procedures. Next slide. This is a screenshot of their isolation sign. Next slide. They stopped their rapid testing because they, for all the reasons that we have read, sensitivity of this test is not real high, and so there's a lot of false negatives and giving you a false sense of security when something was negative, and lots of lag time in the results. Next slide. What they've done instead is have a mandatory modified droplet where they put all patients who have a respiratory illness into modified droplet until proven otherwise that they don't have H1N1, and that has just made a huge difference in decreasing the number of exposures of staff rather than waiting for the physician to say whether or not the patient has it. So some patients that might have been thought to have asthma and turn out to have H1N1. So this kind of eliminates that having a very high index of suspicion, and if you have the isolation rooms, using them in this fashion. Next slide. I just wanted to mention that we do have a place on our website, again, premierinc.com/H1N1 flu or premierinc.com/advisor live, where you can link to all these different resources which have been generously shared by our speakers today, as well as the Premier Safety Institute, so you can download samples, some of these educational documents and Q&As and staff updates are customizable that you can use and for your own staff and customize them for your own individual hospitals. There's lots of information on that, including a link to the CDC interim guidance and a link to the APIC position papers on reuse of respirators. Next slide. Here's the first survey question that we'd like to ask you, and you can basically take your mouse and roll it over your answer. And the question is, do you have an adequate supply of N95s to meet your prioritization plan based on the CDC guidelines? So if everybody would just click on the little circle next to the yes or next to the no, and we will get a quick reading of where we're at on our supply of N95s, at least for the participants on the call today. Lauren, while we're waiting, there seems to be a delay in the slide advancing.
Yeah, that's just because there's so many people on. It's just, you know, and it also depends on everybody's bandwidth. That's just kind of
okay. Nature
of the beast. Sorry.
Oh, it looks like it's split so far. As you can see on your screen, it's still getting recorded. Okay. Wait about another 30 seconds, and then I'll turn the program over to Linda Green.
We've got one more poll after this, don't we, Gina?
Oh, yes, one more poll. Thank you. Why don't we jump to the next one then? The next question is very similar. Do you have an adequate supply of face masks? We have heard that some hospitals are having trouble not only getting N95s but also face masks. So the same question, are you having trouble getting an adequate supply of face masks to meet your prioritization plan? And I see more quickly 73% of the respondents are having difficulty getting an adequate supply of face masks. So the N95s were 50-50. The face masks, 71% say yes, they have an adequate supply, and only 28% do not have enough. I said that wrong. It's about 50-50 for N95s, those that have enough and don't have enough. But right now, at least for the audience on this call, which is nearly 2,000 people signed up for this call. I don't know how many have actually joined the call, but 71% have enough. Okay, I'm going to turn the call over, next slide, to Linda Green, who's going to share her experiences at Rochester. Next slide.
Next slide. Thank you, Gina. I'm going to share our experiences at Rochester General Hospital here in Rochester, New York. And I think one of the things that Gina articulated is a lot of our plans are facility specific. So the hope is that there may be points that you can take home and use in your own facility. And by no means would I say that this is certainly the way to do it, but just based on our own experience. Next slide. Just to give you some background in terms of our system, Rochester General Hospital is a 525-bed acute care hospital. We have at least 40 clinics and practices, two long-term care facilities in our system, a 75-bed acute care hospital, and an independent living for seniors. Next. So in terms of background, it was May of 2009. H1N1 reports from Mexico were consistent with spring break. Our spring break was just coincidentally the same time we were receiving these reports, and we had many people coming back from vacations in Mexico with signs which certainly would be consistent of H1N1. What was interesting is a very slow community spread initially, and then the number of cases of influenza began to increase rather dramatically. Next. What we really saw was an increase in ED volume. Now, our emergency department sees about 84,000 cases per year. So far this year, we're predicting a 12% increase, and if volumes keep increasing, probably more than that. What we did not see, at least last year, was tremendous inpatient surge. We did see ED surge, and particularly in our pediatric population. I think Gina talked about this earlier, but the problems that we saw were the worry dwell, and that was particularly in the initial time frame. Probably our greatest struggle was with the mildly ill, and those were our highest volume of cases coming into our emergency department, and then some acutely ill. And what I will say about the acutely ill patients is that they were really quite ill. They were very, very ill and required admission. Next. So what we did in terms of limiting transmission, identification and separation of patients, and I know, as Gina said, that is in the guidelines. Obviously, things like hand hygiene, giving the patients masks. We used regular surgical masks, both droplet and standard precautions, and that really was our guidance from New York State at that time. N95 for aerosol-generating procedures, a great deal of education, and I'll talk about that in a moment. And we also prepared little packets for patients, and they're actually in little baggies with masks, hand sanitizers, Kleenex, and things like that. So that was very, very helpful as well. Next. In terms of acutely ill, our biggest problem was in our obstetric and pediatric population. And our obstetric population were really those that were most severely ill. We did not see the elderly affected. And just to give you kind of some breakdown, which is pretty consistent, Gina said, only 1% of all of our isolates were in those over 60, 15% in the 40 to 59 age group, and then 84% in the below 40 age group. So you can see consistent with all the information that we do have. Next. So here's a little picture. We have since moved to a brand new emergency department, but I think the take-home message here is obviously twofold. First of all, education, signage, all of those types of things, the hand hygiene. And I think what I've seen when I visit hospitals of my colleagues is that most of us are really doing a very good job at that. So that's just a little picture of what's going on. Next. So what worked well? I think one of the things that I can say is community-wide policies. If there's anything that worked exceptionally well in our community was that we had a community-wide task force. And actually, this was chaired by our health department, which was very, very important. We had a lot of town meetings organizationally, so we called people together. We also had a lot of what I'll call C-suite updates. In other words, short bulleted messages to make sure that we kept administration in the loop. And one of the negatives I sometimes hear is that the people in the trenches are working really, really hard and they're doing all this, but somehow there's a disconnect between what's happening on the front line and what administration knows. So we did regular meetings with them. And then one of the things, and again, we're quite a large facility, so this may not work for everyone else, but we have 5 infectious disease physicians, 4 adult and 1 pediatric, one of whom is the epidemiologist. But what he did do was he appointed what I'll call a flu czar. In other words, one of the other docs, so he could still attend to all these other things, actually ran our flu task force, worked with PR and did all those other kinds of things, and it really did work very, very well. Next. So here is what you can see in terms of June and what we have now. So our peak in terms of cases, and these are just, these are both rapid and culture positive, 6/20/09 last year. You can see that week where we peaked. That was towards the end of June, and then the cases started to go down rather dramatically. Now, probably it's because school let out, and as you can see as you go across through the end of August, we really had very few cases. Now, here's 10/24/09, so just the week ending last week, and you can see the dramatic increase in cases. What's significant about this, and probably more dramatic than one would think, is that a number of our patients are no longer, we are no longer obtaining flu swabs, especially last year. We were culturing just about anybody from all of the offices, anyone with mild illness, because obviously we wanted to see what the burden of disease is. So those 100 cases probably actually represent a much higher percentage than even the peak of last year. And this crept up really very, very dramatically. What we did see in terms of rapid testing is, although statewide the numbers were lower, we saw about 30 to 40% sensitivity. The one change we had to make in isolation protocols, and I think Gina alluded to this with Carol's slides, is we do want to test in patients, but what we do is that we isolate pending culture results. So we do not use rapid test results to discontinue isolation, and we do continue on isolation at least until culture negative if flu is in the differential. So this was a bit different than what had been our common practice. Next. So the challenges, here we are now, we're in the fall of this year, and what are our new challenges? Well, I have to tell you, living in New York State, there are just many, many challenges, and I know you all have challenges, but there was a mandatory vaccine in New York State, both seasonal and H1N1, that was passed as an emergency regulation. However, last week we understood because of the shortage that the commissioner felt very strongly that there would be competition for those resources, so that emergency regulation was removed. There probably will be some legislation that will be proposed in terms of mandatory vaccine. So at that time, I had a lot of challenges, nurses who were really opposed to any type of mandatory vaccine, working with groups, trying to educate them as to the safety of the vaccine. I have to tell you, it was really just a tremendous challenge, and we worked as a team. One of the negatives, if there are any hospitals that have mandated vaccine individually, one of the challenges we found is that sometimes when people are very resistant, sometimes group behavior can be very difficult, and that one-on-one going to huddles, talking to people was extremely helpful. Then we ran into challenge number 2, which was a shortage of H1 vaccine. So all of a sudden now we have a tremendous shortage. We really don't have enough vaccine to vaccinate our healthcare workers, and many of our practices that are function under our hospital license had not received any of vaccine. The third challenge was that we had no thimerosal-free vaccine for obstetrical and pediatric populations, and there is information, obviously, and I know many of you know about that, that the benefit of receiving thimerosal outweighs the risk when there's a shortage of supplies, particularly for pregnant individuals, and that the risk is very, very minimal. The other thing is when we did get our vaccine, most of it was a live virus, and a lot of people, even our young adults, were hesitant to receive that. So part of what we did was we reallocated much of the vaccine that was slated for our employees to our off-site OB and pediatric practices. So those were all things that we dealt with. And then finally, the N95 supply issues. Now, as I said, last year we used primarily droplet precautions, but in trying to prioritize with the CDC guidelines, making sure minimally at least we had 95 N95s for the aerosol-generating procedures, and then trying to prioritize risk, there are some real supply issues. And when we looked at usage of N95s compared to even June, our usage has increased 500%. So some amazing challenges there. I was surprised by Gina's slide that not everyone has had that kind of challenge. So that's some of the things we're facing. Next slide. So let's look at last week now. Well, we've seen an increasing number of cases. Our ED surge continues. What we did have to do is we had to institute visitor restrictions on our obstetric and pediatric populations. And the nice thing about this is that last year we instituted that as well. We said that no children under 18 may visit those units, but this year we really were very, very proactive. We did a press release, and this was community-wide collaboration. I know many of you have read in the papers, and there's really no science behind restricting children and at what age do you restrict them and all of those types of things. But the nice thing about this collaborative approach is as a community, we agreed it would be children under 18 and that we would do it all simultaneously. So we all did it on the very same day. It worked beautifully, and we got none of the negative results. The other thing that we did is based on our CDC guidance document, we revised our OBGYN policies and did recommend in our policies that if a babe is born to a positive flu mom or a suspected H1N1 mom, that we would separate mother and baby. And that's very difficult. It's somewhat controversial, although that is in the current recommendations, and we really felt that we needed to do that. And as Gina said, our policies are there. Next slide. Here's just kind of a little screenshot of some of the publicity that came out. Next. And we have some obstetrical challenges as well. One of our other obstetrical challenge was that our EDs, our filled to capacity, were looking at alternate sites. And in the meantime, we had obstetrical patients waiting in the ED, which was really not good for them. So we developed a triage and assessment guideline where these patients would go up to the obstetrical floor. We found a different area where they would be triaged, where they would be evaluated, and this is for pregnant individuals over 16 weeks, so that those people would almost go into an isolation area up there, but there would be obstetrical nurses who could evaluate and care for them. And I can't see this algorithm very well, but there is a decision tree there on whether or not they would be admitted or discharged. And this really did two things. First of all, eased the burden in the emergency department, and secondly, made sure that these people were being evaluated. And occasionally, we would have to call in our medical hospitalist. So this is our kind of algorithm to do that, and we're seeing how that works as well. Next slide. Communication challenges, rumor control, rumors are rampant, employee education, and we realized that we really needed a single source for information. So all of our information was actually moved from the intranet to the internet, and it includes our policies and procedures. Next slide. So H1N1 vaccine, true or false, I'll just go through this very quickly. Next slide. What we did was we did some educational presentations. You can see then this, some of the rumors. H1N1 vaccine has squalene and aluminin added. And we did this kind of true or false. Next slide. And obviously that's false. Only the experimental flu vaccine have these. And we're doing those in groups. One of our ID physicians prepared these. Next. H1 vaccine has mercury in it. True, but it's been used as a preservative since the 1930s, and there's no evidence of ill effects in children or in pregnant women. And the risk-benefit analysis heavily favors the H1N1 vaccine. Next slide. The live vaccine can cause illness. And it is possible because you can have a minor cold, but as again, as our infectious disease physicians pointed out, you probably would become very ill with the attenuated vaccine. Next. And other vaccines, one of the things that we did is that we have groups actually of experts, and we kind of walk around the hospital, visit huddles and those types of things to really do the rumor control. One of the things we heard on walking rounds this past weekend is that H1 vaccine contains computer microchips in order to trace people. So that's the latest one. And, of course, for those animal rights activists, millions of chicks were aborted to produce the vaccine. So next slide. Priority vaccination, I know Barb is going to talk a lot about employee health and those types of issues, but just that we really had to prioritize that. Next slide. And here is our website. And what I want to point out, which really is a bit unique to us, is that we talked about all the information in all the different places, and we had an intranet where employees could go, and then we had information where anyone could go. So we decided that we were a very, very transparent organization and that all of our information, whether it be internal policies and procedures or any of those types of things, would be posted on the internet. So if you're working in the hospital and you're on your desktop and you hit the flu icon, it's going to take you right away into our internet. And there are a couple reasons for that, too. We have a lot of physicians, a lot of private practice physicians, a lot of people who may not have access to the intranet at that various point in time, and a lot of employees who may want to look at these things at home at their leisure. So we decided we would put it on there. If any of you want to just type in www.rochestergeneral.org when this is over, you can have access to all the things that we have as well. Next slide. So, again, here's all our internal policies. We have our forms there. If you were to click on here, it would say for employees, volunteers, and medical staff members. But, again, everything we have is open to the public. And so we thought this was really a great way so the public could know what our procedures are. None of them are secret, and everything is posted right here. As new releases come out, as new information comes out, that also is posted on the web. Next slide. So in conclusion, we're facing a number of different challenges right now, but we're really optimistic. We have teams that meet. We're streamlining communication. We have evaluated what worked and what didn't work last year. We're constantly trying to prioritize and update our policies and procedures. And I think, again, the message here is collaboration, because there are things that are unique to individual organizations, and there's also a great power in collaboration. So my final slide is, we're certainly getting out of hand with some of this paranoia. And with that, I think we'll go to the next question. So, as Gina said earlier, check all that apply to your healthcare worker sick leave policy. And as she described before, what we're going to ask you to do is indicate which one would best typifies your policy. So paid time off, separate sick days, exceptions when sick leave is mandated, or a policy change in process to encourage ill workers to stay home. And it looks like paid time off, which is combined sick and vacation days, seems to be what is most prevalent in most of the respondents here. So there's a few more coming in, but I think it's pretty much that is by far the most prevalent. So with that, we'll turn it over to Barbara.
Well, thank you, Linda. Can I please have the next slide? Whoops, going backwards. There we go. How about that? Yes, I'm delighted to be here this afternoon and hope that some of the information I share with you will be helpful. And I'm anxious to hear some of the questions and some of the answers that we get, especially when Dr. Bell is able to join us. Could you put the next slide, please? This is Baptist Hospital. If you'll click it one more time. Yeah, Baptist Hospital is the largest hospital in a five-hospital system in the south part of Miami-Dade County, with one of our hospitals being in the Northern Keys in Monroe County. And we also have plenty of urgent care centers and outpatient surgical centers, et cetera. Baptist, where I'm sitting today, looking out at you from the slide, kind of, is 688 beds and with a 100-bed emergency department. And it is always full. Next, please. Swine flu actually did fly into us back in the end of April, early May, because actually our first cases really did come directly from Mexico. Sometimes it was people who live here who had been there on business. Sometimes it was tourists who was coming back in through Miami to go elsewhere in the country. We have a headquarters here for Mexicana Airlines, and so some of their employees, we were seeing them. So it really kind of took off for us in last end of April, first part of May. Next slide. Next, please. So probably what I should have done is preceded this slide with a slide that just said communication, communication, communication. And Linda touched a lot on that. But seriously, to help us get through this, this is something that all of us have had to identify with. And how do we communicate? And there's so many different ways. And I'm going to share a few of those with you over the next few slides and go into some other discussion. But this is a picture of our website homepage. This is our intranet. We also have stuff on the internet for the general public to go on through our main website. But here, if you go on and wherever you click where it says click here, and now next slide, you would see a list of these things. We keep adding to it. So in other words, all of our employees have access to that directly there. And some of these actually I have shared and are posted on the Premier site that Gina alluded to earlier for you to download and use or as a reference or whatever it helps you do. Not all these are there, and there's others that we're adding almost constantly. But it is one way to keep in constant touch with the employees. Obviously, there's other ways that we do that. We do it. Our department has an infection control newsletter. We did a special issue and sent it out to everybody. We've gotten brochures. We have signage. We send emails to all. We attend staff meetings. You know, of course, all this is help them keep up to date with what's going on and also to dispel rumors. You know, to pick up on that rumor that Linda talked about the chips being in the vaccine, I actually had somebody from the community call me and tell me that that was an email floating around, and it said that if by a certain date, if you were checked and you didn't have that chip in you, you were going to be put into an internment camp until the pandemic was over with. Well, of course, we all know that's not a true thing at all, but it's those kind of things we've had to squelch, and it's unbelievable sometimes what employees will actually believe as well. There was also a massive email going around, I believe, all over the country, and in many areas they used Baptist hospitals as a result because there are so many Baptist hospitals in the country, and it was somebody writing and saying, my sister Kim is a nurse at the ED at Baptist Hospital, and they're telling everybody not to take the vaccine. Well, we are still trying to deal with that one, to convince people that that was a hoax and that we totally support the vaccine and will continue to do so. The other thing that we have used ongoing for education is screensavers on the computers. Next, please. And this is one of them. You're going to see a couple more samples as we go through here. And this is part of our second set. We did one back in September when we were actually promoting, talking about H1N1, but at that time promoting the seasonal flu vaccine. This is our second set that's up and running right now, and just today we're finalizing a third set that will go up in a couple weeks into November. And in that one, we actually have pictures of some of our doctors and nurses receiving the H1N1 vaccine as another way to share with their coworkers that, see, I took it, it's okay, it's safe, and hoping that that will convince some others as time goes on. Next. This slide talks about our stand on what we would do about staying home if you're sick. And as most of you know, in the August 5th, 2009 CDC recommendations, it talked about in essence, everybody but healthcare folks could go home, come back to work 24 hours after they're free of fever or signs of fever without the use of fever-reducing medications. We went by the 7 days, and we have opted, as of 10/27, after the new guidelines came out in 10/14, we had our meeting, and we have decided at this point in time in our system, we are sticking with the staying home 7 days from symptom onset or until resolution of symptoms, whichever is longer. We will keep looking at that. We have actually a group now that meets weekly. We instituted that a couple months ago, representatives from all of our system, and we all get together on a Tuesday afternoon to see how things are going. Is there anything else we need to change or add? Who should get the vaccine is one of the current discussions right now, and I'll get to that in a few moments. But the bottom line is right now we're sticking with staying out the 7 days. If we see down the road it impacts our staffing to such a degree, then we will reconsider that. Actually, at one of our recent meetings, what we did revise a little bit is that, of course, our employee health office is very involved here. And as you'll see in another slide in a second or two, we say they have to be cleared to come back through the employee health office. So the health office is trying to work closely with some of these folks. And then after 2 or 3 days, if they check with the employee and they really are practically 100% better, they try to assess to see, well, was this a cold instead of the flu? And some people will probably be coming back sooner. But for the most part, we're going to stick with the 7 days. This is one of our screensavers, and this talks about the use of Tamiflu. And we are following the CDC recommendations. We are not dispensing it out. In the beginning, I will tell you, back in May and even partially into June, if an employee showed up at the employee health office, regardless of what their age, condition, et cetera, were, they were given Tamiflu. Now, obviously, we've changed that. And we only give it to those as following the CDC the current CDC recommendations as who should take a Tamiflu. We do have some that we could use for exposures, but we're very careful about that. It's not just because you walked in a room or whatever the situation may be. You really have to have been right in, close to somebody, very close, without any kind of mask on, and gotten a good sneeze or cough right directly at you. Then you might be considered to be taking Tamiflu prophylactically. Next. This is another in our series of screensavers about, like sort of addressed already a little bit, about if you're ready to come back to work and how important it is that you do talk with your manager, your supervisor, your leader, whatever you might want to call them, about coming back. And again, you can see at the bottom that it does once again refer you to our Sun page, which is our intranet, to get some questions and answers if you have any. One of our current screensavers is going to be going up also adds the fact, you know, that your infection control professionals are always available to you as well. This is a little outline of our protocol about absences that just recently got approved. The slide still says proposed, but it recently got approved and was sent out to all management a few days back. Because one of the big issues that came up, especially using that 7-day criteria, is the questions that would come from employees were, but I don't have any PTO. Time. Here in our system, the way it works is you get so many hours a year. They kind of lump together sick time, vacation time, holiday time. And you're supposed to save at least 6 or 7 days for sick time. But in reality, you can use it any way you want. So human nature being what it is, a lot of people use those 6 days for other purposes. Tag an extra day or two on vacation, take a day off to do this or that. So when they get sick, boom, they have no time left. But unfortunately, we can't help that. If they're sick, they're going to have to stay out because we can't take the chance of them exposing other folks. We also, and we'll talk a little bit more about how we help them get through that as well, but the point is that, as I mentioned before, everything has to go through the health office. Next, please. Back to that question about I have no sick time left. I don't have, how am I going to pay my rent? What am I going to do? We have it in our system, and I'm sure many facilities, hospitals have something similar. Here it's called Sunshine Fund. And people donate money to it. Actually, when we have United Way, if you'd rather your money go to this, it can go to here. People can donate money from the outside or inside from employees. And they manage to keep quite a bit amount of money in it so that if you really, really need it to get something through, to get you through to the next payday or whatever the case may be, there's a mechanism to get money from it. Sometimes it's returnable. Sometimes you don't have to return it. But our pastoral care offices is in charge of it, and our employees find it very helpful. Next, please. Another question we get is, what about my children? My child is sick. I'm not sick, but I have to stay home with my child. Well, we have a contract with these folks called Bright Horizons, where you can call them up and they can send somebody into your home. Obviously, they're well credentialed, they're well screened. It's not just any old person they pull off the street to send to your home. Many of our employees have used it for other purposes, but the company itself, you know, geared up to assist people. And of course, they're a national company; it's not just here. But a lot of our employees have taken advantage of that and been able to get somebody in their home. Mom might want to stay home the first couple of days, but as the child starts recovering, if she has no other backup, no parents, no grandparents, no friends, no family to leave her child with, then this is an option for her so that she or he can come back to work. The question we also get is, well, my child is sick. Well, somebody's getting ahead of me, but that's okay. Somebody will say, if my child is sick, can I come back to work? And we say, yes, as long as you're not symptomatic. You know, if you develop symptoms the day after you come back to work, then you're back out again for your own illness. But, of course, we also remind the importance of what they need to do at home, you know, create a sick room, provide hand-washing stuff around the house, even and possibly wear a mask if necessary in caring for the sick person. I know it's hard not to hug and kiss your child, but perhaps especially a little older child who will understand better, you know, try to avoid that very close contact for those few days. Next, please. Now next, please. Just wanted to touch on vaccine and starting with the seasonal flu. We actually started off great this year. We did so much pre-work and promoting it and everything that when it came, it went like hotcakes. Unfortunately, what happened is, as happened to many of you, is we did not get what we ordered. We keep saying that, or we keep being told that eventually we will get more, probably sometime in November, but not yet. So we were waiting for that to come to finish giving it to folks, but we had a great response and hoping that we have just as big a response next year. Next, please. Back to our screensavers, and this is one that's been up as far as who should get the H1N1 flu shot. We here in the Miami area have just started getting the vaccine in the last, I guess this is our second week now. Somehow or other, I know in other parts of the country it got released a little sooner, whatever the disposition of it was. But we just recently got it in, and we got a very, very small amount the first week. It's just the last couple of days we're actually starting to get any volume in. But we had already, through our weekly meetings, discussed it and created our tier that you see here as to how we would follow the CDC guidelines and, of course, the healthcare workers is what we're using ours in the hospital for. We have tried to work with our obstetricians because we have a very large OB department, and unlike Linda, by the way, we have done the same restriction with visitors to that area using the 18 years of age as the cutoff. So no one under 18 unless you're the father, and we do have that occur here, not too infrequently. But anyway, we're working with our obstetricians to try to, those that did not get vaccine in their office, to provide it for them through some of our urgent care centers. Unfortunately, until the last couple of days, we haven't gotten enough to start that program, but we're hoping the next couple of days we will. Some of our obstetricians have gotten the vaccine themselves and will be giving it, but those that didn't, we will try to make sure those women get covered. Next slide, please. When it boils down to what we're doing here, once it gets to the healthcare worker area, we have developed tiers, and this is what we're in the middle of right now. We started with those first few doses we got with our pediatric ED, because our pediatric ED and our urgent care centers have really been hard hit because the majority of our cases, or at least the ones with symptoms, not necessarily admitted to the hospital, but are children. One of our urgent care centers is still seeing an average of 100 children a day. You know, like everybody else, we had our spike there the end of April into May, a little bit into June. Then it kind of went down, but once school started, bam, it went back up, and it continues to go up. So anyway, we've started with PDED. The last couple of days, they've been doing the adult ED, and now today they've started with ICUs. Next, three of our hospitals have daycare centers, also known as staff early learning centers. We are starting with those because obviously we have several babies less than 6 months of age in those centers, and we want to show our employees that we are the workers there are taking it because we want to protect your children. And we're using that also as a strategy because even though I've talked about we've been offering it, we've had a lot of pushback, especially from PDED nurses and folks. Although the last couple of days they started coming around a little bit, and I'd be interested in hearing if anybody has questions about that, what other people are doing. I'm glad to see some of the slides that Linda had. I plan to use those to talk about some of the myths and fallacies. We've been doing it by going to staff meetings ahead of the employee health folks to try to explain to them the safety of the vaccine and why it's important. You know, and I personally, and I'm sure many of you, not myself, not only as a nurse, but also as an infection preventionist, feel it's a healthcare worker's responsibility, and especially nurses per se, to be the role models and to show the importance of taking these vaccines. So we'll keep pushing on that. Once we get through those areas I've talked about, we'll go to Tier 2, which means staff in all other patient care areas, and then Tier 3 will be all other employees. And our hope, like everybody else, is by the end of the year, there'll be enough for anybody who wishes to take it. We know not all 13,000 of our employees will, but we're hoping that a good percentage of them will take it. Next, please. Of course, we watch for compliance. You know, obviously, as infection control folks, who I'm sure the majority on the phone are, we always are looking for compliance with hand hygiene. And one of my observations, and I'm sure yours as well is that people are a lot better, currently at least, about performing hand hygiene. I keep saying it's a shame that it took something like H1N1 to come along to make a large bulk of people recognize how important it is. However, whatever it takes, and we hope that once H1N1 crawls off into the corner somewhere, that this will continue, because as we all know, that will help us with preventing other types of infections from occurring. Next, please. Well, I wanted to kind of close out with this, and I'm sure many of you have seen it before, but I did want to talk a minute or two about masks and share with you what we're doing here at Baptist. We've had many discussions about it, especially after the revised guidelines came out, and we are having some problem getting N95s. We do see TB patients in this part of the world, and even OSHA has said, be sure to preserve your N95s for TB patients, and then next, make sure you have them for those aerosol-producing procedures. So this is what we are doing. We are putting the majority of our patients, or all our patients, are on droplet precautions. If you are going to do an aerosol-producing procedure on that person, then you should wear the N95. We have N95s available, not to any, you know, we're not abundant in them. We don't want to, you know, we want to preserve them for what people need. But we also tell people that if you want to wear an N95, I'm not going to come rip it off your face. But please try to help us preserve it so that we have it when you really need it. You know, we don't want to go to the lengths of this picture you're seeing, although we may have to get creative down the line as to what we do if this continues on and we have trouble getting both surgical masks as well as N95s. And I want to take this opportunity to comment. One of the handouts that Gina referred you to was the APIC reuse white paper on the reuse of respirators. As vice chair of the APIC Emergency Preparedness Committee, I want to let you know that that is currently under revision. In fact, there's emails, as we talk today, flying back and forth between the committee members trying to finalize the revisions to send them on back to the policy committee and others within APIC to get them out there as soon as possible. We also have just recently finished, and again, it's going through the approval process, two other documents. You know, last year we did one about infection control and shelters during disasters, and we're just getting two more signed off. One is infection control during disasters in alternate care sites and one in ambulatory care sites. So look for those shortly on the APIC website, and I think I'll turn it back to Gina at this point.
Thank you, Barb. I think we have another question that we're going to be asking. Yes. Check all that apply to your current situation. Whether staffing shortage requires changes in your patient management, visitor restriction policy, emergency department triage in an alternate site other than your ER, and concern among healthcare workers receiving H1N1 vaccine. And while you're answering that question, I just wanted to comment on the last question that we did about paid time off. Nearly 70% had this paid time off, which is what Barbara alluded to, that you could take the time for anything, whether it be sick or vacation. And at a recent Center for Infectious Disease Research and Policy meeting, a SIDRAP H1N1 conference, it was interesting because there was a healthcare track and a non-healthcare track, and when you compare the difference in sick leave policies, it was very different. Healthcare seemed to focus more on a set of days that you could take whatever, which seemed to promote people that were sick, as Barbara said, to come to work when they were ill because they didn't have any time off, paid time off. And so compared to the business side of it, where there were specific sick days for the employee or the family. So I was also surprised in that there were very few people that said there were exceptions if the sick leave was mandated. In other words, that additional paid time would be provided if you told an employee they had to be off, like if they had an exposure to varicella or H1N1 or something. So that was kind of a surprise. Also, I wanted to comment that in the resources that I showed you, the website, premierinc.com/H1N1flu, where there's a lot of resources from today's program, as well as sample policies from Rochester and Baptist. There's a set of flu updates for staff, and one of them, they're developed by the Premier Safety Institute. One of them is about myths and realities about H1N1 vaccine. We developed this for our staff here at Premier. We used the myths and realities from a variety of different CDC websites to create a very comprehensive one. So take a look at it if you're struggling with developing educational information for your staff on H1N1 vaccine. Okay, let's look at the answers here. So staffing shortages requiring changes in patient management, that's not happening too much. Visitor restriction policies, about 29% have had to do that. Emergency triage in alternate sites, about 3%. And concern, which is up to 62%, which is not surprising.
Gina, this is Barbara. You know, the question said check all that apply to your current situation, but it will only accept one. If you click a second one, it takes out one. So that's not a full, true response, I don't think.
Well, thank you, Barb. Oh, boy. I guess check all that apply doesn't work. Well, this is the first time we're using this survey. That's unfortunate. We'll have to thank you very much, Barb, for pointing that out.
Uh-huh.
Okay. All right, let's move on to the question and answer session. And joining us in the question and answers, in addition to Linda Green and Barbara Russell, our faculty, we have Judine Bartley from the Safety Institute. Judine Bartley is very well known in infection control on a national level and has been on many audio conferences. I wanted to see if Michael Bell has joined our line yet.
Yes, I'm here.
Oh, hi, Michael. How are you?
Good, thanks. I've enjoyed listening.
Thank you so much for joining us. Dr. Bell is the Associate Director of Infection Control in the Division of Healthcare Quality Promotion at CDC, and he's been generous to give us a few minutes of his time to help answer any specific questions that we might have. And so I'd like to instruct the operator to tell our participants how to record a question.
At this time, if you would like to ask a question, press star, then the number 1 on your telephone keypad. Once again, to ask a question or make a comment, press star 1. Your first question comes from the line of Linda Wilson.
Hi, this is Linda Wilson. I have a question for Barbara and maybe Dr. Bell. I've been in infection control since 1980, and we educated on the CDC guidelines with the N95s, then the Florida Department of Health came out with the guidelines that surgical masks can be used except for aerosolization of particles like Bronx. Then the CDC guidelines came out again saying N95s. I have a lot of employees now that will not take care of flu patients unless they have N95s. We have a shortage. And I want to know if they refuse to start taking care of patients because we have no N95s because OSHA and CDC recommended this, what are we supposed to do?
Dr. Bell?
or would you like to go first?
You go right ahead.
Okay. Well, so let me start by saying that, you know, what you're seeing in this whole picture with regard to respirators and masks is a clear reflection of the type of evidence that we have. If we had wonderful, perfect evidence to say that you absolutely needed respirators, there would not be a section in the guidance to say that when you're running short, it's okay in certain situations to use a surgical mask. Likewise, if we had clear evidence that all you need is a surgical mask, we would never recommend respirators and all of the, you know, sort of side effects of doing so. So we're in a situation where there's not perfect evidence to say 100% one way or the other, and so we're trying to take a rational, measured approach. There may be some value in using a respirator, but we certainly know that the bulk of that value is with certain things like aerosol-generating procedures, or more importantly, even tuberculosis patients and so on. So making sure that the use of respirators is focused on those things and then is, you know, extended if possible is the intent of the guidance. The issue of how you deal with individuals who are dealing with fear for whatever reason, I think is somewhat separate from the evidence and the recommendation itself. And that gets to a question of, you know, pragmatism, frankly. I don't think it's ever a good idea to withhold something from an individual if they're desperately in desire of it. Having said which, it is an indication that additional education would probably be helpful. I think that people very naturally grasp towards protective equipment when they're uncertain and frightened. And granted, the current situation certainly lends itself to that kind of uncertainty. So if I were in those shoes, even though it's not a perfect solution, I would lean towards very frequent in-services and updates and try to answer questions as thoroughly and repetitively as possible. But aside from that, dealing with fear can be a big challenge.
Thank you. And I do daily in-services. I am up in the area, specifically my ICU, that has this concern. But the issue is that we educated Florida Department of Health, which is still on the website. CDC recommended something else. Well, they go by CDC guidelines. So it's fine for us to educate, but if we don't have enough of the N95s, they feel that we are not protecting them. So it's not that we're withholding anything from them. It's just if we don't have them available because there's a shortage and it's recommended to use it with the flu patients, that's when we're going to have the issue. And I know education is important, but I don't think that's the issue here. They know that they're supposed to wear it for CDC guidelines. They don't think that there should be a shortage, and they want the mask. So that's my issue. I don't think it's education. I appreciate your response to that, but I really don't agree
Linda,
with that.
Linda, this is Barbara. Linda, this is Barbara.
Hey, Barbara.
You know, the same kind of people that say that to me are the same ones that are declining the vaccine.
That's not my issue here.
But I mean, what I say, one of the things I say to them is, you know, the CDC says, you tell me the CDC says you wear an N95, the CDC also says you should get vaccinated. And if you get vaccinated, that's going to give you protection. So whether we have N95s or not, you'll even have a better protection by taking the vaccine. And as I mentioned, we do have some N95s here, and we don't take them away from somebody if they really insist. And I think that makes them feel a little bit more at ease. Well, it's there if I really – it's sometimes what you can't have, you want. You don't have, you want. But knowing that it's there, they most of them have gone along with wearing the surgical mask. And then the N95 for the aerosol procedures.
I'm glad
thank you for your perspective. It's really very helpful.
Okay,
so
thank you.
The next question.
Your next question comes from the line of Lori Neat.
Go ahead.
Lori, your line is open.
I have a question if anybody has actually increased their environmental cleaning. We have a pediatrician that's insisting that our general waiting area be cleaned every hour.
Hmm.
Well, I think what's important is that, this is Gina, that when your environmental cleaning gets done correctly. I think one of the challenges that we've had that's been shown in a couple of research papers recently is that frequently touched surfaces in hospitals are not cleaned routinely. And so if H1N1 does anything in the hospital environment, it gets frequently touched surfaces cleaned appropriately. What the frequency of cleaning should be, that's really up to the individual facility. I don't know if there's any indication for hourly cleaning, but when it's cleaned, there should be some monitoring to make sure that it's done appropriately.
Okay.
Thank you. Next question.
Your next question comes from the line of Nancy Branham.
Yes, hello. Thank you for taking my question. What I wanted to talk about was, you know, the change in the guidelines. Prior to the change in the guidelines, we were providing N95 for TB patients and aerosolization procedures. And, you know, now that the new guidelines came out, we have to take a look at, and we're now expanding our use of N95s more as a precautionary measure against having any action, I think, more than anything for not perceiving not to protect our employees. However, the reality is we've been monitoring very closely throughout this process where we have zero patient to employee conversion of N95, or I'm sorry, H1N1, and we have more issue with employee to employee contacting H1N1. So the increased use of N95, you know, in our health system is really just to respond to this to the new guidelines. It's not really something that's going to impact the results that we're seeing here in this facility. So I'm wondering if you could speak to that and what type of data was collected around this change in policy.
You know, I just wanted to just preface that the guidelines, the CDC guidelines, and Dr. Bell, you can, you know, add to this. The CDC guidelines do a wonderful job of explaining, you know, the rationale for these respirator guidance. And, you know, based on, you know, not a perfect set of data that can tell us exactly what we need. And they give lots of options for how you're going to choose, what you're going to use for respiratory protection, who you're going to choose it on, whether you're going to possibly reuse the respirators, what are some alternatives, and what higher levels of protection that you can use. And it's all going to be based on what's going on in your individual facilities, your patient populations, what the belief is of your pandemic preparedness committees that read these guidelines and apply them for your individual setting. So just as a general statement for that. So Dr. Bell, if you wanted to take that one.
Sure, thanks for that. So it's interesting to hear your comment and your concern. I think I would, I'll say a few things about how much I agree with you in just a second. But just to clarify, the updated interim guidance actually should be putting less stress on your respirator supply than the original interim guidance. The original interim guidance didn't make any accommodation, really, for using anything other than respiratory protection for dealing with H1N1 patients, whereas the updated version, as you just heard, has a number of elements in it to try and accommodate a lot more flexibility in terms of how each particular facility decides to do this. Having said all of that, if you look at the updated guidance, you'll find that in contrast with previous guidance, the use of protective equipment is way at the bottom of the list. And the reason for that is that early in the season, not the seasonal flu season, but this very, very long H1N1 season that we're in, the analysis that we did demonstrated pretty much exactly what you're saying. In very rough numbers, we found about 30% of healthcare personnel with H1N1 appear to have contracted their infection from home or the community, another 30% from other ill colleagues who showed up at work, and then finally about a third of them from possible patient exposure. And as you very well appreciate, putting on a respirator to take care of patients would not have protected those individuals from, you know, over 60% of the infections that we identified. So that's one reason why the use of respirators is not at all prioritized as the main important thing to do, but rather vaccination, appropriate triage, so on and so forth, source control, are much more the focus of the updated guidance.
I think the challenge, though, is you know, we've got, you know, the Florida guidelines, the CDC guidelines, and the OSHA guidelines, And I think we're needing to react more to the OSHA guidelines to prevent ourselves from being in any kind of violation of their standards.
Yeah. If you actually take a look at what they're going to enforce, they're very much in line with the flexibility that's been designed into the interim CDC guidance. We worked very closely with OSHA to make sure that they would be willing to allow that flexibility, and they're certainly in agreement with that. So, you know, I would take a look at the website, the OSHA website, in terms of their plans for enforcement.
Yes, we will continue to monitor that, and have had many meetings over the last week and a half trying to interpret all of the different positions that these organizations are taking.
This is Linda, and the only comment that I'd like to add, when you said that employees actually transmitted infection from employee to employee, is looking at some of those practices that employees have, for example, bringing in the shared trays of food and you know, the potato chips that everyone reaches in the bag and those types of things. And so we found that we had to put some restraints on that, too, to decrease employee transmission.
I think that the person asking the question is really highlighting what all the challenges that we're facing and, you know, what your state's talking about, what the CDC is talking about, and what OSHA's talking about, and then trying to apply that to your individual setting and coming up with something that really works. And it certainly is a challenge, as reflected in some of these questions. And as I said earlier, the OSHA is going to be coming out with a CPL, which is their enforcement document, to provide some guidance on how they will be looking at this hierarchy of controls that Dr. Bell explained, and the flexibility that they will offer in how you comply. So it'll be interesting to see what that includes. But thank you for your question. Next question, please.
Your next question comes from the line of Amanda Lampe.
Yes, I have a question regarding the basal vaccine and giving it to healthcare workers. I read what the CDC said as far as healthcare workers, you know, caring for immunocompromised patients shouldn't be receiving the nasal vaccine. Like, does that include my NICU staff, my nursery staff? I'm just leery about like healthcare workers getting it, like ER staff. You don't know if they're going to be taking care of like a heart transplant patient versus, you know, someone that came in that needed stitches.
Yep.
So.
Yep. This is Mike. I'll just jump in. We spent the past week dealing with this because it is a very important question. And the bottom line is the immunosuppressed populations that we're talking about, for which there's evidence that they're at greater risk, are really the transplant populations. And when we approached our influenza colleagues and our pediatrician colleagues, the bottom line was LAIV, the live attenuated virus vaccine, is perfectly appropriate for NICU staff. The bottom line being that even if you were to shed some of the attenuated virus, the risk to the individuals that you're taking care of is nothing compared with a wild-type infection.
Okay. Thank you.
Mm-hmm.
Next question.
Your next question comes from the line of Candace Geek.
Go ahead.
Hi. My question is from a risk management perspective, and I wanted to know what type of mask should we recommend for families or visitors?
Is that for me?
Whomever.
Okay. Well, so I think the main thing is if there's a concern that individuals visiting are going to be at risk, then having them not visit to the greatest extent possible, that needs to be step one, so limiting who shows up. And then for the, you know, one caregiver who's absolutely essential or you know, for the visitor who's really necessary for whatever reason, then making sure that they're not in a high-risk setting like an aerosol-generating procedure or what have you. Beyond that, I don't think it's likely to be helpful to have that individual try to wear a respirator. I think that just as we're saying that if you're not doing a high-risk procedure or taking care of a TB patient and we're in short supply, it's okay to use a surgical mask, well, I think that would extend very rationally to the visitor population by saying, you know, we'll ask you to wear a surgical mask. We don't require you to wear a respirator.
Okay,
if they showed up with respirators from the hardware store, I wouldn't keep them from wearing them. But I don't think that there is a requirement necessarily that they be given a respirator.
If there are limitations on surgical masks, is it unacceptable to ask them to wear another type of mask? You know, if you're limited in your surgical mask supply for your staff, I guess my question is it inappropriate to provide less than a surgical mask?
Like...
I know there was a yellow dust mask they talked about.
Oh, I see what you're saying. I think from a practical perspective, any simple barrier would be appropriate since you're not trying to get a face seal or anything like that with a surgical mask.
Okay.
I mean, part of the rationale for wearing the surgical mask is to help reduce touching of the face, the mouth, and the nose. So that would also, an alternate type of a respiratory protection would help with that.
Yeah, our concern was, you know, we are limited with the N95 and the surgical masks, and, you know, there was some discussion about what is appropriate for us to provide for visitors and families when, you know, we're limited in the supply to provide the N95 or the surgical mask for our staff. Thank you.
Thank you.
Your next question comes from the line of Lorna DeGarzia.
Oh, yes. I think my questions were answered. I missed the beginning of the conference call because I couldn't get the live web access. But essentially what I'm looking at is in general, we're staying with the droplet precautions, private door, private room door closed, and just the surgical mask, unless there's aerosolized generating procedures going on, then we're using the N95 respirator. So I just wanted to see, listening to a few other participants, that seems to be the process, and I want to make sure I'm in compliance.
Well, have you reviewed the CDC guidelines that talks about the prioritization scheme?
Yes.
And you've created a prioritization scheme that has N95s when available for cough-inducing procedures, and then and you've outlined exactly who's going to be using the masks and in what situations.
Well, we have a draft. I'm going to drill it down further, so I'll refer to the document. I was waiting for the final document from OSHA, but it sounds like I shouldn't wait.
Lorna, this is Linda, and in New York State, I recognized your voice. In New York State, I think, though, the State Health Department is going to come out with some guidance to kind of help us determine those priorities, and my understanding is that may be coming out very shortly.
Okay.
As well as APIC coming up with some information which will help us prioritize that a little more definitively.
Very good. Thank you for your information.
And as the person asked a couple of questions back about some of the challenges with different recommendations, I mean, some of the state health departments have recommendations that are slightly different than what the CDC has recommended. And then you have, you know, OSHA's how they're going to interpret it, and as Dr. Bell said, that they've kept very close contact with CDC in developing these guidelines. So hopefully the prioritization that is going to evolve in all of these settings, whether it be the state health department or individual hospitals, will reflect your current situation and be acceptable if it meets the criteria that that's based on your supply, your healthcare workers, and your particular exposure episode. So it'll be different in every setting. Next question.
Your next question comes from the line of Myra Kevlin.
Hi, my question was also in regards to N95 respirators. I'm in a long-term care facility where we have never even been fit tested for N95. We're now, since April, trying to stockpile supplies. And am I correct with the OSHA guidelines? In order to use N95 respirators in a facility and to do fit testing, we first have to institute a respiratory protection program.
Yes, I believe there is a requirement for a respiratory protection program anytime a facility says that the employees need to use respiratory protection.
We need to institute that program and get fit testing done before we can even actually begin using N95 respirators.
Yes.
Well, I don't know what the, so I'm not going to speak for OSHA. I don't know if there's a prescription against using them, but if there's a stated requirement, if you feel you need to use them, then in order to do so officially, then I think you're supposed to have a respiratory protection program.
This is Jardine Bartley, and I'm speaking from an experience here in Michigan where we spoke with our MyOSHA, and I think that they have a good understanding of the constraints that everyone has. But I believe that if they had occasion to come to your facility, let's say on a complaint of something unrelated, I think they would look for that good faith effort. But I think they fully appreciate the fact that long-term care has not needed to use them, and up till now, because of the way we had, tuberculosis referrals to acute care. So I think what I would do is look, develop the program and start, but not be fearful of starting, the use while you try to fit test the number of people that you think may need it, depending on the number of patients you believe you will have in which they are required. That's just one experience, but I think they do understand, but they would indeed look for that evidence that you've attempted to do that.
Next question.
Your next question comes from the line of Pam Vaccaro.
I think my question has been answered. I don't dare ask another N95 question. I wanted to thank all of you very, very much. It was very informative. Don't know that I will be able to establish the comfort zone that people tend to think that you'll be able to do. And, Barb, we have limited N95s, but we also have no vaccine at the present. So, we're a little bit more of in a quandary here. So the only good news I think we might have is that we normally don't have serious influenza-like illnesses until a little bit more into the December, January. So hopefully by that time we'll get something. But, again, employee concerns are huge, and the prioritization schedule is great, but fear factor is still going to be just out there, and I don't know that there's a real great answer to that. But thank you all very much.
How many more questions do we have on the line, operator?
You still have about 9 in queue.
Okay. We're probably only going to have time to take one more question, and it's almost 22. I know we started about 5 minutes late to make sure everybody got online. But if you want to send in a question, we can post the answers to some of these questions on the site with the rest of our resources. You could send your question to Lauren, Lauren, underscore Solis, Solis, at premierinc.com. That's Lauren, Lauren, underline Solis, Solis, at premierinc.com. So let's take the last question.
Your final question comes from the line of Beth Samuels.
Thank you. My questions have also been answered. Thank you.
Okay, well, then let's take one more.
Okay, if your question has been previously answered, please press the pound key now. Once again, if your question has been previously answered, please press the pound key. Okay, your final question comes from the line of Rita Smith.
Hello, can you hear me?
Yes. Go ahead, Rita.
I was just hoping for a little more information about what modified droplet isolation means. So I would appreciate that. And I would say that back here in the Middle Atlantic area, we're having a desperate time getting masks. So we do not have them in great supply. We're getting them in little bunches. So I just wanted to add that from here.
Well, I shared what the modified droplet was from Minnesota, and part of that modified droplet came from a recommendation from the Minnesota Department of Health. And I'm sorry I don't have any more information on that, as Carol was unable to join our call today. But we can register that question and answer it when we answer the rest of the questions. But that came, the modified droplet came based on a recommendation from the Minnesota Department of Health for hospitals in Minnesota.
Okay, great. Thanks.
Uh-huh. And I think the criteria for it are listed on the slide. And as you can see, they're a little bit different than what the CDC recommends for droplet precautions. And that's why they call them modified droplet, because they're not exactly the same.
Sure. Okay, thanks.
Uh-huh. Okay, well, that ends our program, and I'd like to thank Dr. Michael Bell for making himself available for our questions and answers. We are truly grateful, and we can hear all the challenges that we have with H1N1 and reducing risk of transmission, and lots of questions on respirator use. And, again, I urge everybody, knowing this is a challenge, to meet with your, you know, hospital folks and others in your area, in your community, and talk about some of these strategies together as this rolls out. And when we get the information from OSHA, I'm sure it'll be posted in many locations, including the Premier Safety Institute. So we'll be interested to see how they're interpreting inspections. They only come out for complaints. They're not doing any routine inspections on this. So that brings us to the end of our time. I'd like to thank everybody, Judine Bartley, Linda Green, and Barbara Russell, for joining us to today's program. Materials for the program and the audio file will be at premierinc.com/advisorlive, as well as links to all the resources we talked about today. Thanks so much, and we wish you a great afternoon. Could I ask the faculty to stay on the line after the call? Thanks so much. Bye-bye.
This concludes today's conference call. You may now disconnect.